So, what do you say?
Nah, but thanks anyways.
Nobody was buying what Ray Kroc was selling.
How's it going down there?
Well, a lot of interest.
Until he made a discovery.
This is the most remarkable restaurant.
My brother's brilliant idea.
And took America along for the ride.
There should be McDonald's everywhere. Franchise the damn thing.
The founder is superb.
Ray.
What?
No!
A tribute to American innovation.
Now who's with me?
Michael Keaton is incredible.
Only in America.
The founder. Rated PG-13.
Well, welcome to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan, here as always with
Luke Savage. Welcome back, everyone.
And, you know, we're just chilling out today. I was just at McDonald's, and I was doing the thing like Michael Keaton does in The Founder when he sees McDonald's for the first time, and he's going, wow, wow. And he's looking under the hamburgers and seeing the mustard, and he's going like, what? Wow.
Well, Will has dived headfirst into exactly what I wanted to talk about, because just by chance, you know, kind of born of some random Netflix scrolling, my girlfriend and I watched this movie, The Founder, last night, where, you know, Michael Keaton plays, you know, one of the founders of McDonald's. And, you know, I was a little ambivalent about watching the film, but holy shit, when we were like 20 or 30 minutes in, I was like, I have to talk to Will about this. God, I hope he's seen it. I mean, it is pure ideology. Absolutely incredible movie. I mean, not actually, but...
I saw it with our mutual friend Alex Ross. We saw it theatrically, as a matter of fact.
This
is the kind of movie I would not see theatrically anymore. It's like, I used to have this like brain disease where I would need to go see all the Oscar movies in theaters.
I was going
to
say, I feel like this is sort of an under-commented on type of moment in the Michael and Us universe where I'm like... Will, I streamed a film last night. And you're like, yeah, I found that. I saw that theatrically when it came out, actually.
Oh, yeah. I saw The Founder, that movie everyone loves and talks about theatrically. Aren't I cool?
Okay, so this movie, let me tell you, folks, if you haven't seen it, it has everything. It has a scene where Michael Keaton, early on, drives up to a drive-in. The drive-ins are all the rage, and his food takes forever to get there. And when, you know, the nice lady roller skates up or whatever with his order... it's wrong, and he's, you know, he's sitting there and he's thinking like, there's got to be a better way, you know. And then it's got a scene where he pitches McDonald's as a franchise model to the two
franchise.
Yeah, his accent fluctuates somewhat throughout the movie. I feel like it gets less folksy throughout the movie. Maybe that's intentional. I don't know. But so he's this, you know, hard scrabble sort of striving type. He's got all these failed schemes. His thing is that he sells, milk mixers, like for making milkshakes or something. And his attention is caught by, you know, these brothers in California who order six of these things. And he calls them up because it must be a mistake, right? Drives out there. He's fucking blown away. He's like, they're making hamburgers like with Fordism. It's like Uber, but for hamburgers. Like we have to do this. But the brothers, folks, they represent an older, gentler kind of capitalism. They don't want to, but seriously, I know. Like the film is pure. It is pure ideology. So they're like, I was expecting some bullshit Tom Hanks, Mary Poppins style movie where it's just kind of, you know, wholesome, and it's like, here's how this nice capitalist gave you this thing that you love or whatever.
Well, Saving Mr. Banks, I think, is an even more brutal film than this one, actually.
Well, it's more brutal because it's...
same filmmaker, by the way.
Oh, really?
Same director, John Lee Hancock.
Holy shit. So this curator of pure evil, John Lee Hancock.
His name is literally John Lee Hancock. I mean, he's a man... That can't be his real name. He's like... I am America. That's what he's saying to you.
Well, so Saving Mr. Banks and The Founder, in many ways, kind of similar films in that, you know, they're both about a capitalist, you know, bludgeoning something wholesome and, you know, extracting value from it.
And taking something independent, some like small fry person's hard-earned dream.
That's right.
And stealing it from them.
That's right. But in Saving Mr. Banks, I mean, the output at the end, you know, what's produced is Mary Poppins, which is a thing we all know and love. And the film wants you to kind of treat it whimsically. It's kind of, you know, they play the actual audio of these recordings where, you know, the author of Mary Poppins, forgive me, I'm forgetting her name, she was making sure that they got every granular detail, you know, correctly or whatever. It's supposed to be sort of wholesome. Not so with The Founder, where he goes from being this kind of, you know, failed small-time capitalist who maybe is a bit of a snake oil salesman to this, you know, corporate overlord. And the way he does this, an amazing scene, my favorite scene in the movie, is when he's pitching the McDonald's brothers on this franchise model. And he's like, guys, I've driven through every small town in America. And what do they have? They have two things. They have a city hall where, you know, there's an American flag flying over top of it, fluttering in the breeze. And then they got a church where wholesome people, you know, gather. And then he pitches McDonald's with its golden arches that one of the brothers has come up with. They've had a few restaurants they've opened, but, you know, they haven't, they're not really interested in expanding it further. One of them in Phoenix just has this arch and he drives up to it and he's like, that's brilliant. It's this perfect synthesis of like the sacred and the profane. It's got this big yellow arch that makes it look kind of like a cathedral or something, but then it's just a drive-in. And he explicitly pitches it to them as this synthesis of the two things that make America great. The flag, which symbolizes, you know, American freedom and liberty, and the church, which is, you know, where all the wholesome people gather and where, you know, good Christian values are instantiated. So McDonald's is literally Athens plus Jerusalem, folks. And that's how the film explicitly pitches it to you.
Now, does the movie, I haven't seen it since it came out, obviously.
In theaters, you saw it.
In theaters.
Will saw the movie theatrically, folks.
Yeah.
In case you didn't pick that
up. I was there on the ground floor. sometimes I like to go to the Young and Dundas Cineplex just to kind of like relive the moment, you know. Does the movie create room for ambiguity? Like, doesn't it sort of pitch Roy Kroc, the Michael Keaton character, as a like anti-hero of some kind? And is there some space to suggest that, like, well, when he's saying that thing about church and state, like, maybe you're supposed to look at it with at least a slightly jaundiced eye and acknowledge that he's a snake oil salesman?
I don't know, man. I mean, maybe in the sense that a lot of films like this aren't, you know, straightforwardly ideological because they, you know, they're trying to compromise between too many things. And they're also making compromises for the sake of narrative. So maybe that's kind of true. We're supposed to feel bad for the McDonald brothers who he fucks over.
But, you know, if you want to make an omelet, you got to break some eggs, don't you?
I really think that's the message of the film. It really is holding Michael Keaton up as this like Randian archetype, this Howard Rourke, you know, Promethean creator. And I think the point of the film at the end is sort of like, look, you can feel bad for the McDonald brothers, but look, they represented the old way and like the new better form of capitalism, which is like the hard scrabble working class, you know, populist capitalism where you go from rags to riches and you're trying to expand and you're breaking down every barrier in your path and you're being as unscrupulous as possible. It's like, this is the thing that we need to celebrate because that's what gives you McDonald's. There's a statistic they put up on screen at the end that says something about how McDonald's feeds, you know, 1% of the world's population every day. And I think the message is very clear. It's like Michael Keaton may have fucked over his wife, Laura Dern, which, by the way, Laura Dern is in this movie. The film is so cruel to her character. Her function is to play his first wife, who is analogous to the McDonald brothers because she just sort of believes in this older, small time, you know, wholesome type of, you know, local capitalism or whatever. And she doesn't support his Promethean ambition to become a globetrotting corporate overlord. And we're supposed to kind of be on his side, really. I mean, again, the film is telling you, well, he's a bit of an asshole, but...
Don't you love those Big Macs?
Yeah, right. And there was a scene that I didn't really, get, and but my girlfriend's interpretation of it, I thought, was bang on, which is, there's this whole thing where Laura Dern and Michael Keaton keep going to the country club. You know, he's getting the people there to invest in McDonald's franchises. And at one point, he cancels their membership to the club. And he's like, we don't need them. We can meet a different class of people, a better class of people that's more appropriate or something like that. I'm going to take you somewhere else. And then it feels like a bit of a non sequitur because then they're in like this VFW hall. And they're eating with all these working class people. But then he starts conscripting them to various tasks within the, you know, various roles within the McDonald's organization. And this is why the film is pure Reaganism. It's like, you need all these hardcore strivers. The old bourgeoisie, all they do is sit around and invest money. They're just the money men. And what we need is like a populist capitalism that marries, you know, good old-fashioned American liberty with, you know, the good old-fashioned Christian values of, you know, your local Pentecostal church or whatever. Absolutely incredible. I was astonished at how kind of, how ideological this movie about the founder of McDonald's was.
It makes me want to watch The Social Network again, which this movie is very, very obviously indebted to. Like, it's an almost point-for-point ripoff of it, because...
I think that's a better movie, I would say.
Yeah, I think The Social Network is quite a bit less sentimental about its central product, Facebook.
And its central character. I mean, the final scene in that movie is that, you know, he's looking at his own Facebook profile, the website that he started that's made him into a multimillionaire at that point, maybe it's a billionaire at that point, and like the girl who originally rejected him still won't add him on Facebook.
In the end credits of that, you know, that one also has captions on the screen. And aren't those captions something like the Winklevoss twins, you know, made off with $500 million or right. something? He has $1 billion. It's like, it's not saying, and Facebook serves over a billion yeah. customers. It's more like, listen, you followed this drama for 2 hours. Ultimately, everyone's fine. You don't have to be sympathetic to anyone, not even the Winklevoss twins. They're doing okay. And it was created through no higher ideals. It was created through a hot or not, like, gimmicky dorm room revenge porn operation, yeah. basically.
Yeah.
So, folks, if you haven't figured it out yet, this is a very special episode of the Michael and Us podcast. We're doing something a bit different on this episode. We're having a Michael and Us film festival. We're talking about various movies we've seen recently and giving them a good old-fashioned ideological reading. It's kind of like show and tell. We're bringing movies, we're showing the other person, and we're going to give our little theories, we're going to give our little interpretations, and then we either pass or fail the test.
I love that exposition of what show and tell what is, just in case people don't know.
Can I tell you a story about my own experience with show and tell?
Go on.
So when I was in senior kindergarten, I always had the best show and tells. I had so much showmanship. One time I brought my dad in to juggle.
Hang on, just to
interject. Have I told this story
before? No, you haven't, but to interject for a second, you know, that is a funny territory that I hadn't considered because, let's be honest, you know, I'm not thinking about kindergarten show and tell every day, but there was a kind of, there was very much like a one-upsmanship to that, wasn't there? This like... this whatever like weird type of competition exists between four-year-olds very much came out during show and tell.
Anyway, my teacher, a wretched person, just terrible.
Your kindergarten teacher?
Yeah, she was awful.
How insidious can your kindergarten teacher have been for you to refer to them as wretched?
I mean, she was an unambiguous racist.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, I don't want to speak ill of the probably dead, but...
You will, and you just did.
A very racist person. She would give out like a sticker that said a super show and tell to people who did the best show and tells.
Oh.
And of course, I coveted them. And
okay, well now, I really think she was insidious. I mean, you already told me she was racist. Now you're telling me she's like picking favorites in show and tell and she's got like a pay to play like award system.
So, you know, I had this great showmanship. I had, you know, I brought my dad in to juggle. Like, who's doing that? I brought a whole vaudeville act. No one else was doing that. Didn't get a super show and tell sticker. In fact, I think she was annoyed that I brought my dad into her safe space. And I remember complaining to my mother about this and she suggested I bring in acorns because teachers like nature stuff. They like educational stuff like that. So I brought in acorns. I got the super show and tell sticker.
Wow. So that just shows you, you know, super show and tell was always a rigged game. It's just like capitalism, folks.
Well, it's like the Oscars, you know, the best stuff never wins.
You're right. It is more like the Oscars where it's like, the thing that wins is the perfectly perfectly middle brow thing, like 9 times out of 10. In this case, you know, acorns are Green Book or whatever.
So for my first show and tell, I'll tell you about a recent film, a movie that's playing in theaters right now that I saw this week called Last Night in Soho by Edgar Wright. I saw this with friend of the show, Chris Berube, and, you know, we just wanted to hang out and we picked this movie because it was the only like watchable seeming movie playing in that part of town.
What else was there?
Well, I mean, like, you know, I'd already seen The French Dispatch. Right. He'd already seen something else. So it's like, okay, right. Last Night in Soho. And the days leading up to it felt like this Bataan death march to this movie that I probably wasn't going to like.
Well, Edgar Wright's, I mean, the Cornish trilogy is really good.
Yeah, he's done good stuff, definitely. But this one, the hype around it was not so good. Anyway, for the first hour, I was kind of enjoying it. People are saying it's a giallo riff. It's really more like a Roman Polanski movie. It's like a Repulsion, but I guess you can't say that on a press tour anymore. It's set in the modern day, but has flashbacks to the 60s. And it's about this, you know, rural British teenager who goes to a cool fashion school in London to become a fashion designer. And, you know, she's overwhelmed by the big city, overwhelmed by her dormitory. She ends up moving into this little out-of-the-way house that's run by an old woman played by Diana Rigg. And when she goes to bed at night, she has these visions, these vivid flashbacks of this woman in the 60s played by Anya Taylor-Joy, who, like her, comes to the big city hoping to pursue her dreams, in this case, to become a singer or a performer. Now, I am going to get into spoiler territory here, folks. I hope you don't mind. The Anya Taylor-Joy character, this woman in the 60s, meets up with this man who seems to be like a producer, like a star-making type. But it actually turns out that he's a pimp. And so he forces her into prostitution. And the modern woman, played by Thomasin McKenzie, has these visions of Anya Taylor-Joy being killed by her pimp. And, you know, there's some ambiguity. How much of this is real? How much of this are her delusions? Now, Thomasin McKenzie, the modern-day girl, is obsessed with 60s fashions, loves the 60s aesthetic, wants to create 60s-inspired costumes in her class. The last act of the movie goes off the rails spectacularly because we find out, again, big spoiler, the Diana Rigg character actually was this girl. She was Anya Taylor-Joy. She actually wasn't killed by her pimp. Instead, she killed her pimp. And she did it as revenge for having been forced into this life of prostitution. And she started becoming sort of like a Sweeney Todd for all of these Johns. She's killing them one after another. And their spirits, like, haunt the building. And now she's going to kill Thomasin McKenzie because she's found out her secret. Anyway, the house catches on fire, and just in the last moment, Thomasin McKenzie realizes, wait, she was right to do this. She was right to kill all those Johns. She's actually a good person. So anyway, Diana Rigg dies, and the last scene is Thomasin McKenzie is perfectly fine. You see a fashion show where all of her cool 60s-themed designs are being shown, often on gender nonconforming models. And the implication is she has taken the aesthetics of the 60s and divorced them from the era's sexism. We may like the swinging 60s, but it was a very sexist time. And the last shot of the movie is her looking at Anya Taylor-Joy in a mirror, and they give each other a kind of wink. Now, ideologically, the movie is really muddled, because I'm uncertain if Edgar Wright is saying either, good thing we've left behind all of the sexism of the 60s in our more enlightened present day, because, you know, let's face it, sex trafficking, prostitution, not only are these more complicated issues than he would want us to believe, but they're not specific to any one era. They're not a uniquely 60s thing. Like, it's happening now, it happened 500 years ago. Very strange thing to hinge your vision of 60s sexism around. Or is he saying the legacy of the 60s, the sexist legacy of the 60s, is still lingering over us now? We're still feeling its ambient influence. Because the movie shows that only arguably two people are feeling its ambient influence. Everyone else has forgotten about it. And in fact, London is just this, like, cesspool. It's just this, like, evil, scary place, no matter what era you're in. And then, on top of all that, I think it takes a little bit of gall for Edgar Wright to, like, create this Anya Taylor-Joy character, who's a sort of two-dimensional sexpot, a very manic pixie dream 60s character, and then say, oh, but, you know, isn't it a shame that she was forced into this most degrading thing of all, sex work, and all those horrible men who soiled her and sullied her. Isn't that just terrible? But good thing that she can serve as an inspiration to women nowadays who are liberated from the sexism of the era. She's a martyr for modern day women. It's somebody who's seen what happened in 2017, seen the Me Too era, and taken just the wrong lessons, or just had a very distorted perspective on what the lesson should be. It's like, he saw 2017 and he was like, yeah, abusers really are bad. And that's why you have to get rid of all sex work. And that's why all those awful Johns need to be killed. It's a good thing that we're eradicating that. Like, that's not exactly what the problem was. It's just this really weird funhouse house vision of what the zeitgeist should be. And it's just amazing that the movie made it past the script stage. Like, it's just so kind of tone deaf to what the moment is.
Well, I was already on the fence about seeing that one, and I think I will definitely not be watching it now. I mean, what you're describing does not sound like a fun, you know, Hot Fuzz, Shaun of the Dead. What was it? What was the third one, At World's End?
Yeah, that's a good movie.
I actually quite liked that. Yeah, I might watch that again sometime.
Yeah, I haven't loved him all that much ever since the Simon Pegg ones. I think, I don't know, there's been... did you see Baby Driver, for instance?
No, I didn't.
I don't know.
You didn't like it?
Not so hot, in my opinion.
Because I actually think, you know, of those three, I know Shaun of the Dead is the most famous one, but Hot Fuzz, I think, is really peak Edgar Wright. I love what that movie's doing. Mm-hmm. I love that he made a it's not serious, but I love that
it works as an action
movie. It works as an action movie. It's very, very funny. Frost and Pegg are a great duo. They've got great chemistry. And the movie is kind of this, you know, comment on something very real in English culture, English society, which is, you know, these kind of like very small local tyrannies in these Tory areas of like rural England. You know, the Kinks have that song, The Village Green Preservation Society. I mean, that is a movie about the Village Green Preservation Society. And like, you know, the tyrannical Tory voters who both whimsically run the local flower shop and also enforce political discipline on like everyone else in the rest of the town. Great movie. Also, much of it filmed in Wells, which is a town I know very well. Like the cathedral that gets blown up or whatever is a cathedral I've been in many, many times. I know that part of England almost better than any other.
It's an accurate depiction of the kind of small town British life.
Well, in certain parts of Britain, right? I mean, it's like the Tory party base is very much, you know, obviously in a big way, it's like the city of London and, you know, it's like the metropolitan bourgeoisie and, you know, it's not just that it has this rural character, but there is this kind of old rural, you know, character, the sort of landed gentry, that kind of thing, but also just well-off retirees in small towns and stuff like that in kind of the southeast and the southwest as well. Like that is like a big sort of part of like the Tory base. It's sort of like if you read into Lord of the Rings, like what the different groups are, right? The Shire is one part of the Tory party's base, and mm-hmm. and Lord of the Rings is about how like we have to protect this. We have to protect this at all costs from, I don't know, Eastern Europe, which is like the orcs, and like they're the Soviet Union. They're the feral proletariat that's coming to homogenize everything, and we have to protect the Tooks and the Ganges and all the rest of it.
By the way, speaking of Edgar Wright, did you ever see Scott Pilgrim versus the World?
Is that Edgar Wright? I didn't even know. I mean, I never saw that. That was a big phenomenon in Toronto when it came out.
Yeah.
Because what? It's filmed here.
Filmed here. It's set here.
Michael Cera was in it.
That's right.
Something.
It's based on a series of graphic novels that are set in Toronto.
I feel like I kind of missed the window on that one.
Well, you did.
There was a thing kind of that turned me off when it was happening in Toronto, which is just I felt like there was a certain kind of annoying person that I met in my film studies program who was so into that movie, who was so kind of dressed in the regalia of that movie for like several months. And I was like, I don't want anything to do with this.
Well, pleased to meet you, because that was definitely me. I mean, when that movie came out, yeah, it was a Titanic level cultural event in certain blocks of Toronto. Not the whole city, but Bloor and Bathurst.
Bloor and Bathurst was gripped by Scott Pilgrim fever.
I mean, when it was filming here and then when it came out. And
oh God, I hate that. I hate that. That is the most Canadian thing ever and the most Toronto thing ever. When there's just Americans come here to film and then we treat that as an event. It's like, God, what is a movie where Bay Subway Station gets destroyed?
That would be Suicide Squad.
Right, of course. And it's like people treating that as like, oh my God, they're here, they're filming. I don't care. You know, this is a world-class city. Let's act like it, folks.
Well, okay, but on the other hand, let's say that you are 21 years old when Scott Pilgrim came out. You look exactly like Michael Cera. You have exactly Michael Cera's level of masculinity. He is living exactly your lifestyle in that movie.
Here's the thing, Will. None of these things were ever true of me. I've always been higher T than Michael Cera. I've never been 21 years old, and I never lived that lifestyle.
So, you know, I saw it when it came out, obviously, and then I saw it again 10 years later. And seeing it in 10 years later was such an emotional experience. Like, I was watching it and just remembering that time, remembering all the people I used to know, remembering the boy I used to be. And obviously, the movie is not as good as it was when I was 21.
So is it good?
I can't. You know, it's... if you see it on Netflix, by all means, watch it.
Yeah.
It's worth watching, but I think you will find that it's not as good as it was when I was 21.
When I was 21, it was a very good year.
Now, Luke, you were telling me that you've seen the recent cultural phenomenon, the Tiger King of our current era, Netflix's Squid Game. I haven't seen it because it's 9 hours long and, you know, I'm a busy man. I'm a podcast mogul.
Yeah, you're so busy. You were able to watch something which, you know, maybe I can ask you about after, which was what, some kind of zombie movie or something where one of the stars was in Plan 9 from Outer Space.
It's not a zombie film. It's a Christian film,
oh,
sir.
Excuse me. That's what,
even better.
this is what takes away your time to watch Squid Game, the literally like the biggest cultural phenomenon in the world right now. Folks, believe the hype. Squid Game is really, really good. I started watching it, I guess it was last Friday or something. Been kind of it had, you know, been in the queue for a while. Like, let's watch one episode, see how it goes. I think watched about 5 episodes, so almost 5 hours worth of it on Friday, and then finished it the next day. It's really, really good. I mean, I don't...
A lot of people think it's about capitalism, but I actually think it's about communism.
Okay, we'll have to probably do an episode on it. I mean, I can't promise that because I don't know if Will's going to watch it, but maybe I'll like deputize some guest who's seen it and give Will a week off or something. But yeah, we'll have to read from that article it's actually about communism or whatever. But in the same way that Parasite does, you know, tonally it's very similar to Parasite. You know, it manages it to combine kind of sardonic irony and humor with, you know, extreme violence and brutality. But, you know, also similar to Parasite, it manages to exude a very strong, you know, political critique while also just being incredibly entertaining, engaging drama. It's totally gripping. And you watch an episode and you turn right to the next one. You know, maybe we should kind of save it and not tease too much of it out about here if you haven't seen it. But if there's anyone listening and you haven't watched it yet, you really are in for a treat. I wish I could watch it again for the first time. But Will, since it's come up already, I mean, I have to ask about this Christian movie with the Plan 9 from Outer Space person. What the hell was that?
Well, our listeners are going to like this because this is also an anti-communist film. It's called it's called Bill Wallace of China. It's from 1967. And I fell into a bit of a rabbit hole to discover this film because it stars Gregory Walcott. And it was also co-written by him and produced by him. This was a Gregory Walcott passion project.
Can you remind people who are not as perhaps quite as immersed in the Ed Wood cosmos as you are, which character this is?
More than happy to. He played the leading character, Jeff Trent, the heroic airline pilot, and he's somebody who kind of fell into the Ed Wood universe by accident. He was a member of the church that put up most of the money to make Plan 9 from Outer
really?
Space.
Really? That's where they got their, like, you know, handsome male lead was from the church?
He was from the church, and he's somebody who already had a bit of a Hollywood career. He was a contract player at, I don't know, Warner Brothers, somewhere like that. Had a lot of supporting roles in big Hollywood movies. And he did this movie as a favor to the main financier. And after Plan 9 from Outer Space, he went on to a very long, quite successful career as a character actor. He was in 4 Clint Eastwood films. He was in Steven Spielberg's The Sugarland Express. He had a really great performance in a movie called Prime Cut with Gene Hackman and Lee Marvin, as well as lots and lots and lots of TV. And then when Plan 9 from Outer Space was rediscovered in the 80s, Gregory Walcott was very upset about this. And he would constantly be like, oh, it's the worst picture I ever made. I don't know why anybody wants to talk about that picture. It's terrible. In fact, he's in the Ed Wood movie. He has a cameo as a potential financier because at a certain point, he started to kind of make peace with it. He started to be like, well, you know, I wish I was remembered for some of the meaty roles I used to have, but, you know, it's better to be remembered for something.
Yeah, he had his own sort of Pete Best moment. Like, there was a moment, I guess, where Pete Best decided that he was gonna move on from his phase where he's coming out with an album called like Best of the Beatles and then just be like, all right, I guess this is what I'm going to be known for. So I'm going to go to Beatles conventions and be like billed below Ringo Starr, who, you know, can't even be bothered to show up.
I mean, that's basically what happened to Gregory Walcott. And, you know, he would say in interviews, you know, I'm retired, but I still get fan mail and it's all for that picture. So anyway, I recently read
it's all from Will Sloan.
I recently read his autobiography, which is called Hollywood Adventures, and it's actually a very charming book. It's a collection of just anecdotes about famous people that he met, directors he worked with, very low-key, charming anecdotes. And in the section of pictures, midway through, there's a picture of a poster for this movie called Bill Wallace of China. It says, Gregory's film that he produced and starred in. mentioned nowhere else in the book. I'm like, what's the, there was a, because he was mostly supporting roles. It's like, what's this movie that he starred in? I could find no information. It's one of the few movies that is nowhere online. Not even like the secret torrent sites have it. But what I did find was a trailer that the Bill Wallace Memorial in Knoxville, Tennessee put up, which is this, you know, evangelical church. And the trailer features Gregory Walcott. He's like, "Hi, I'm Gregory Walcott. You know, some actors dream of playing Hamlet. Some actors dream of playing Macbeth. I always wanted to play Bill Wallace." And he was talking about, "We took our cameras to the east and captured Hong Kong in all its majesty as we told the story of..." And it's the story of this American man who was a doctor in southern China, you know, during the war and then after the war, and ended up being persecuted by the communists. That's the story. And I thought, oh, this sounds amazing. I have to see this. And the trailer made it look like this is a movie that might have had some money put into it. How did this movie so completely fall through the cracks? So I got, this trailer was put up 10 years ago by the Bill Wallace Memorial. So I sent them an email and I said, "Hey, you said you give out DVDs of this. Could I possibly have one?" They responded, "Oh yeah, we love to share Bill Wallace's story." And I said, "Oh, thanks very much." And they sent it for free. No shade on the Bill Wallace Memorial.
Wow.
You know, good for them.
No, that's great.
They're fantastic people. Love them. The movie, though. The movie is so bad. You know, it was based on a Time magazine article and a book and Gregory Walcott's own interviews. So apparently at some point he read this Time magazine article and he was like, "This Bill Wallace is incredible. He is the nicest man, the best man ever, that he went and helped all these people. And then the commie scum killed him. I have to tell this story." And so he plays Bill Wallace as the most saintly man who ever lived. Not a bit of texture on this character. And it has this narration that is just constantly laying on facts about Bill Wallace and how great he is. I wrote down a little bit of the narration. At one point, there's a scene of Gregory Walcott as Bill Wallace just like pacing around in front of some a rural Hong Kong landscape, the kind of landscape that a young Jackie Chan would have fought in front of. And the narrator says, "Bill Wallace had graduated from the University of Tennessee Medical School. He went on to do specialized study and research at Harvard and the University of Pennsylvania. Fame and prestige were never part of his ambition. However, word of his phenomenal surgical accomplishments reached medical authorities in the United States, and he was elected as a fellow of the International College of Surgeons. Bill was naturally grateful for this distinguished honor, but his biggest reward was when he was able to bring healing to a sick child or save a deformed street urchin from a life of loneliness and ridicule. It has been said, if you want to find Bill Wallace, find the sickest patient in the hospital, and there he'll be." Now, the narrator is saying all of this just as Gregory Walcott's walking and pacing in front of this scenic landscape. And you're listening to it and thinking, okay, this guy loves Bill Wallace just a little bit too much. Like, we need a bit more of a character. And all of these facts mean nothing to me if I don't, like, so I'm spitting all over the mic because I'm getting so excited talking about Bill Wallace of China, a movie that I had to create a Letterboxd page for because so few people have heard of it. Now, you may be thinking, how could anybody have a bad word to say about Bill Wallace? He sounds like a great guy. All the locals love him. The children love him. Well, Mao's army comes in through the north. Bill Wallace isn't a fan of this communism stuff, but he's like, "Well, we need to make peace with them just so we can keep the hospital open." But unfortunately, having a beloved American in the south of China gets in the way of the commies' propaganda because they're trying to vilify Americans. They're trying to say that America is the great Satan. And having this guy around is causing too many people to say, "Well, wait a minute, this guy's an American. Isn't he good?" So they ended up smearing him, slandering him, calling him an American spy. They parade him through the town, say he's an American spy. And then it all leads up to a wonderful scene where he's arrested. There's a communist bureaucrat who's trying to get him to sign a confession. And he's like, "Maybe we can save your life if you just sign this confession. Look, I'm trying to cut a deal." And Bill Wallace, unflappable, not a moment of self-doubt, nothing bad about this man, goes into this monologue where he's like, "Sure, the communists may have China at this moment, but you won't last because man yearns to be free. Man yearns to own his property. Man earns to..." And then you know, we never know what happened to Bill Wallace after that. Some say...
It's like, today McDonald's serves 1% of the world's population.
But, you know, today you can still visit the Bill Wallace Memorial because the propaganda didn't take root because everyone still loved Bill Wallace. Oh, man, there's a siren out because they're trying to arrest me for...
We get sirens so often when we're recording, we have to use that joke sparingly.
So this movie is very boring, first of all. I wouldn't recommend people seek it out.
I'm guessing of all the movies we've talked about on this episode, this is probably the one that you should watch last.
It's like I'm 40 minutes into this 90-minute movie, and I'm like, why am I doing... Has Gregory Walcott fandom really led me to this?
If the rule you follow.
It's like I could literally be watching any movie in the world right now. I have film history at my disposal, but I have reached out to the Bill Wallace Memorial in Tennessee to get a free DVD of this movie.
Couldn't watch Squid Game, but you're watching this.
and yeah, it made me want to be a tankie. I mean, I get it now.
Now, there's a film that both of us saw recently that I think we both liked an awful lot. I saw it this week, and I was really excited to tell you about it, and then I discovered that you'd also seen it this week. What's the film, Will?
The film is Bergman Island by Mia Hansen-Love, and I loved this movie. I thought it was just terrific.
So I had no idea what to expect going into the movie, because when the prospect of seeing it was first mentioned to me by a friend, I kind of figured that it was a documentary about Faro, however it's pronounced, the island, Fur, whatever it is.
There is, in fact, a documentary called Bergman Island about him in his later years.
That's right. So, you know, there's this island in Sweden where, you know, he used to do a lot of his writing, and it appears in a lot of the Bergman films. And so it was only kind of, you know, I had this murky sense of what it was, and then I kind of picked up on the fact that it was sort of this, you know, film festival movie, and it was a drama. And so I wasn't really sure what to expect, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's a very airy and sort of a dreamlike film that's quite peaceful to watch, but also I think has a lot of subtlety, has a lot of ambiguity, definitely unlike anything I'd ever seen before. The plot is basically that this couple, both of whom are filmmakers of some kind, you know, they come to the island to write. They're staying in Bergman's house, which apparently is a thing that you can do.
Yeah, they've turned Bergman's kind of estate into this tourist attraction where people can do artist retreats, basically. They can work in his home and soak in the vibes. And then people also take tours of, you know, because Bergman shot so many of his later movies near his home. So you can see, you know, where Through a Glass Darkly was shot, or you can see the beach from this movie or that movie.
And the male character, who's played by Tim Roth, is also there to present one of his films, I guess, to a, you know, respectably sized audience and a quite adoring audience. And you kind of get the sense that it's a source of tension in their relationship. You know, she struggles with a lot of writer's block. You know, he's got a fan base of his own. It's unclear quite how famous he is, but I mean, famous enough that he can go to Sweden and have people say, you know, you're my favorite filmmaker, I love everything you do.
Probably a little bit more successful than her. Just enough more successful that it can be a source of tension. But not so much more that they feel outmatched.
Right, exactly. So, you know, it's very subtle, their relationship, because there's nothing actually wrong. They, you know, they clearly have great affection for one another, but there's also just something slightly off-kilter. And the film, you know, presents this in an incredibly realistic way. And so, you know, much of the middle section of the film is taken up with the characters going around and visiting various pieces of Bergman lore and kind of, you know, Bergman artifacts. And I absolutely love this because the film is simultaneously somehow able to celebrate the fact that, you know, some of these places, some of these objects, some of these rooms actually really do seem to, you know, exude some kind of special aura, but also it's able to lampoon the absurd fandom that's, you know, popped up around all this stuff. So like the scene on the Bergman tour, for example, where she stands him up on the Bergman tour. She rightly does not want to go on it. He gets caught on the bus. I love that scene.
There's a certain ambiguity as to how much this really matters, to what extent this is just kind of a tourist trap.
Some of it is so stupid. It's like the tour guide at one point is showing them a rock wall and is saying, like, you can see this in Through a Glass Darkly, but also this part of it was rebuilt. And she points at sort of the specific stones that have been, you know, replaced since Through a Glass Darkly was filmed, you know, 70 or 80 years earlier, whatever it is.
But then there's that funny scene later in the movie, too, where she said, I spent all day looking for the house from Through a Glass Darkly, and I couldn't find it. And he says, oh, well, it wasn't a real house. It was just a facade. Bergman Safari.
And then yet, at the end of the film, like, she goes off and she finds Bergman's actual house, or I don't really get it, because there's one where they're staying, and then there's a different one.
There are a couple couple of different properties, one of which he had his private library, his, one of which it seems was his real house, and one of which was a place where he worked sometimes.
Yeah, and I recognized it immediately because, I'm pretty sure it appears in Wild Strawberries. It appears in at least, one of his films. That part of it, I've seen pictures of, inside of that house. I kind of know the rooms. They're familiar to me.
Isn't it oddly breathtaking when they're inside the house? Like, you see the video collection and you see the books, and there's just this. I'm not quite sure how the film manages to do it, because it looks like the most ordinary house in the world, and yet when you're in the house, there's this sense you suddenly have of like, oh, this is really it. This is the real space.
That's right. There's something so qualitatively different about it than the house they're staying in, which has been turned into this kind of tourist trap. Now, this is the part where if you're planning on seeing this film, which, I'd recommend it certainly, you probably should skip because there will be spoilers here, but I just don't know how we can talk about this movie and what it's doing without, mentioning certain other things about it. There's a sequence midway through where Chris, the female lead, is describing a film that she's in the process of writing and she's struggling with. And so you get this quite lengthy film within a film. I mean, there's these whole other characters that you become acquainted with. And their plot is that they're kind of star-crossed, but simultaneously sort of doomed lovers who were involved when they were teenagers and then years later kind of reacquainted, but they both sort of built separate lives and they're meeting up on this island for a wedding and they can't quite quit each other, but they also can't quite commit. So there's a lot of emotional and sexual tension going on as they're at this wedding. But then something really astonishing happens just in the last 20 minutes of the movie. And seriously, if you're planning on seeing it, you could really skip this part. And seriously, last spoiler warning here, because there is a bit of a twist ending, but we can't talk about the movie without discussing this. Chris falls asleep in the Bergman house, and when she wakes up, the male lead from her own movie is standing there, and you think, what is this? Like, is this a dream? What's going on? But then it turns out that he's actually very real. Suddenly, she's no longer struggling to write the movie. She seems to be filming the movie. The movie seems to be a really big deal. And so the dynamics are very much reversed, where now, the Tim Roth character, he's gone off, he's taken a ferry off island to go pick up their daughter. And, what's been kind of lingering behind the whole movie, and, which is obviously drawn directly from Bergman's own life, is the fact that sometimes in these creative partnerships, and, the dynamic is often a very gendered one, one partner does all the kind of parenting stuff, and, the other one, usually the man, is just sort of, creating. Bergman was one of the greatest artists of the 20th century, but was a terrible father. I mean, how many children did he have from how many different women? How many marriages were there?
Bad husband, too. Yeah, often an unpleasant man. The movie has an interesting conversation with that because, you have an island like this where you go there implicitly to sort of soak up Bergman's greatness, get his vibes, and to use those vibes to help you in your own creative project. But what vibes are you soaking up? Are you soaking up the genius who made Persona, or are you soaking up the bastard who walked out on his wife one day and that became the subject of Scenes from a Marriage? To what extent are those things extricable from each other?
Well, because their funny detail is that they sleep in the bedroom that's the bedroom from Scenes from Marriage.
Right.
It's like, wait, isn't this bedroom kind of cursed? Should we really be wanting to soak up the aura here? Now, it's worth saying that, the movie is quite gentle. The Tim Roth character is not, he's not an awful person at all. It's just that there's something in the relationship that's not really clicking. But so then in the final sort of arc of the movie, when all of a sudden it seems like Chris, she's actually the much more successful one, kind of flips the dynamic in a very Persona-like sort of way. There's almost a role reversal. And it's, unclear what the status of the final 20 minutes are, and then by extension, what the status of the 80 or so minutes that precede this final 20 minutes actually are. But the result is something that's thoroughly enjoyable, really thought-provoking, and it was just a very gentle and peaceful sit. I actually saw it in a really small theater at the TIFF Bell Lightbox.
Cinema 5, baby.
Where, yeah. That's right. Good old Cinema 5. I had not been there for probably 2 years.
It was my first trip back too, actually.
And actually, I think the last thing I saw there was a Bergman documentary of some kind, or might have been Cries and Whispers with the same friend. And yeah, we just had a wonderful time. I'd never seen the Lightbox. The Lightbox was like Dawson City after the Gold Rush. I'd never seen so few people there, but it was wonderful to be back. I can't wait to go back again.
Well, that was the Michael and Us Film Festival. I got some rental recommendations for you. Next time you find yourself at the video store, go to B for Bergman Island, pick that up. And then while you're in that section, pick up Bill Wallace of China.
Yeah, just write to the Tennessee-based Memorial Foundation and they'll send you your free copy.
Again, no shade on them. Bill Wallace, if he was half as good a man as he was depicted in that film, was a really good man.
An unusual motion picture is coming your way. This is the true story of a Tennessee doctor who became a legend among the people of South China. I'm Gregory Walcott, here in Hollywood. When I was a boy, I had a hero worship for admirable men. And I haven't changed. I still love a hero. One day I read an amazing story of another hero. His name was Bill Wallace. The story had all the ingredients for an exciting motion picture. I decided to film his story. I want you to meet just a few of the characters. This is the boy Lee, a homeless urchin that wanders the streets.
Just what I thought. Cleft palate. I'm a doctor. I want to help you. You come with me, nobody's ever going to chase you again.
Hey, buddy, I think this young man will have a look at himself. Got a mirror there? Thank you.
Say, Lee, how would you like to become an orderly in the hospital?
Be home. As long as you like.
You're a number one doctor. If you say so, okay.
This is Mr. Chen, the mayor of Wuchao.
It's hard for me to understand a man like yourself. Has he be a bachelor at 41?
Well, evidently, nobody will have me.
Nobody will have Dr. Wallace.
What is it, Evelyn?
Mr. Chin has a very important matter to discuss with you, Dr. Wallace. Oh?
Dr. Wallace, I'm very proud to present Miss Sen. She has consented to be a wife.
This is Everly Hayes, the head nurse of the hospital.
Everly, don't get mixed up in this.
But they can't treat you as if you were some sort of a criminal.
It'll be all right. Now, the important thing is you take care of yourself. Then whatever you do, don't say anything that gets yourself in trouble with that official.
This is the red official.
If you will sign this confession, the party has agreed to grant you amnesty, and you will be free to return to the United States.
And I play Bill Wallace. Every actor has an ambition to portray some character. Perhaps it's Hamlet or Cyrano de Bergerac or Abraham Lincoln. With me, it was Bill Wallace. And it was quite a challenge. He was a man of cool confidence. He had a way of making people happy. He enjoyed life to its fullest. He was a human being.
Charles is dead. Why did you wait so long to bring her here?
We took our cameras to the ancient villages near Hong Kong to capture the colorful enchantment of the Orient. The intrigue. The marvelous faces. He was a giant amid China's most explosive era. He was a man of deep conviction.
Yes, you won China for a while, but you will not last.
We will last.
You will not last.
It's a movie that will delight the entire family. You won't forget this picture. I hope you'll see it. And whatever you do, don't leave the family at home.